Before we get into today's episode, I wanted to let you know a few things. In lieu of a sponsor this week, we have donated both the space and money associated to Cultural Choice Association to support their work in preventing Aboriginal youth suicide. This is an issue we've spoken about before on the podcast and is one I'll personally always make space to talk about, as it's one of the issues I'm most passionate about. You're about to hear all about the amazing work Cultural Choice Association does, and if it inspires you, we ask you to consider donating whatever you can to their latest fundraiser, the link to which will be in our show notes. Unsurprisingly, this conversation also comes with a content warning, as there are discussions of suicide and depression. Yama, I'm Marley Silver, and this is Always Was, Always Will Be Our Stories, the podcast where I sit down with some of the country's most inspiring Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander role models. In 2017, the latest published statistics revealed suicide as the leading cause of death for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people between 5 and 17 years old. And over the past 5 years, despite the fact that we only make up 2.8% of the youth population, one in every four Australian children who have died by suicide was Indigenous. Prior to invasion, suicide was not a concept known nor seen in our communities. And a Senate inquiry into this epidemic facing our young people today has revealed it is directly correlated to the intergenerational trauma, disconnect from culture, and related disadvantage caused by colonisation. Each of these numbers represents a child, a name, an empty seat at the dinner table, a life full of opportunity never to be fully realised. This issue is one of the hardest to discuss because often the deeper you go, the more questions you have. But it has to be talked about. And thankfully, like my guest on today's episode, there are incredible people out there committed to making a difference. Gamilaroi man and Newcastle Knights player Connor Watson was set on a few things from a young age. He was going to play in the NRL, and no matter what, he was going to find a way to give back to our mob when he got there. Connor, alongside his amazing mum Jodie, dad Mark, and younger brother Fletcher, have turned family tragedy into passion and hard work, driven toward Aboriginal youth suicide prevention through their non-profit Cultural Choice Association. I'm really privileged to have seen the work the association does on the ground and the impact it has on our young ones. So I couldn't be more thrilled to be bringing you Connor's story and a glimpse into that work in today's chat. Throughout this discussion, please remember, it's okay not to feel okay, but it isn't okay to not do something about it. If you need help, call Lifeline on 13 11 14. And now it's into the show. So I start every single podcast with the same question. That old, you know, age-old one that we blackfellas know very, very well, which is, what's your name, who's your mob, and where are you from?
Hello, I'm Connor Watson. I'm a Gamilaroi man, and my family's from out Walgett, but I reside in Newcastle now. I actually grew up at Avoca Beach, so I was born in Dubbo. I lived there till I was young. I was like four, I think, when I left. Majority of my family are all out Canamble and Dubbo now, so that's where they still are, and we moved to Avoca, and I spent pretty much my childhood there. I was about 18 when I moved down to Sydney, and then now I moved up to Nui like 3 years ago, so it's good.
So you're a proper saltwater boy now, having spent this much time by the coast.
Yeah, it's I could never not live near the beach now, I think. I'm sort of very grateful that my parents decided to move to Avoca when they did. Nothing against, growing up in Dubbo, but I couldn't really, complain about my childhood. It was good growing up by the beach, learnt to surf when I was young. So, yeah, it was good.
That's a pretty big move, hey, like from Dubbo to Avoca, very different lifestyles and all that sort of stuff. But what was it like growing up there?
Yeah, it was a massive move. I think mum and dad used to go on holidays to Avoca, so that's where it started. I think that's where the seed started for them. And I remember going there on holidays when I was probably like four, and then the next year then we moved there. So it all happened pretty quickly, but it was a great place to grow up. Like as far as sporting goes, like there's been so many surfers, professional surfers that have come through there. There's been a fair few rugby league players. Like I play with The Safidi brothers, who I went to high school with, Tom Starling, who plays at the Canberra Raiders, I went to high school with, and there's like a bunch of guys through the NRL that come on the Central Coast, like Jesse Ramian, trying to think who else, Nicho Hynes, he's at the Storm. I'm definitely missing a few. Scott Drinkwater at the Cowboys. Like, there was a lot of guys that have made the progression to professional footy. So I think growing up there, it was probably like a good spot for me to go and try and crack it, just because there was so much talent around. It probably made me excel a bit more.
Yeah, it sounds like a really strong culture. I was going to ask, was, you know, now you're obviously, this is your job, it's your career. Was that like the dream as a little kid?
Yeah, I think at one point I wanted to be a professional surfer, but you got to be realistic sometimes, and I don't think I was any good. I used to have in my head that I was a really good surfer, but yeah, I was probably just making it up a lot of the time. So yeah, playing rugby league was always a goal. Like, yeah, it's just sort of been instilled in me from day dot. All I can remember from Dubbo is playing footy and like going to watch my dad play footy, and even like my first mate in Dubbo was Cade Ellis, who plays for Penrith. So it's pretty crazy like how it all sort of worked out. But yeah, I'm definitely glad that I get to do it for a job now.
Yeah, and that's so cool that there's like people from your childhood, like you guys have got to kind of get there together, even if you haven't been like exactly side by side all the way through and everything like that. Like, it's pretty special. And I think I used to work with young kids, and so often like the young boys are like, I'm going to play in the NRL. I'm going to play in the NRL. And you kind of go, you should probably have a backup plan, but it's special to actually make it. So that's pretty awesome. And I know that, when you did move down to Sydney, it was originally for the kind of final years of high school. And I wonder if you can talk about that experience and how you ended up at pretty flash school.
Yeah, it was crazy. I was playing like a little bit of rugby union for Avoca, but I always wanted to play NRL. So league was my main focus, and it sort of worked out if we were playing a late game in league on the Saturday, so say like a 3 o'clock game, and the rugby union team in Avoca would be playing at 10 or 9, I'd go down to, because it was just around the corner from my house, so I'd just run down there, go and play a game of rugby union, and then rest up and then go play league in the Arvo. And there was a couple of us boys doing the same thing, and me and one of my mates got like sort of, I guess, identified by this he was like a scout for the Lloyd McDermott rugby league team. Yeah. And he wanted us to come along and play trial for the Lloyd McDermott team, which is just I think they call it the First Nations rugby now or something. I don't know if they changed the name, but it's basically the Australian Indigenous team. And yeah, we ended up making that team. So there was guys in there from like New South Wales, Northern Territory, Queensland, like up north, and, you know, there was TI boys in there, and yeah, it was awesome. We actually like did a trip over to France and France and Belgium. So we played like a bunch of their teams over there, top 12 or 14. I think the comp's called top 14 there, and we got to play their sort of under 18s teams, and then we played in a national championships at Riverview, the high school, the private school, sorry. And yeah, Knox were there watching, and they ended up basically getting me and one of my mates, Jimmy Witters, a scholarship to go there and study and play rugby union, which was, yeah, it was pretty cool. So I ended up going to Knox as a 16-year-old and finished my last 2 years of school there. But it was something that, it wasn't really in the picture at all, like, and then it just sort of happened that way through playing a bit of footy. And yeah, I'm very, very grateful that that did happen, because it's definitely changed my life.
It's interesting because recently my sister and I have been talking a lot about how a lot of the like quite successful blackfellas that we know who are our age and kind of travel in the same circles as us have come out of the private school system, and we feel in the minority having gone to just our local public school and whatever. And it seems like those kind of education institutions do a really good job of instilling like confidence and like, I don't know, getting kids to think really big about their dreams and that sort of stuff. And I wonder, you know, you hear a name like Knox, and it's probably one of the most recognizable private schools in the country, you know. And what was that like? And you said it changed your life. In what way did it do that?
Like the first time I walked in, because I wasn't really that set on going there. I was like, I don't know. And then I just walked into school, and then I was like, yeah, I think I'm going to go here. But I think the biggest thing that happened to me, like it just instilled a work ethic that because like on the Central Coast, it wasn't like there was a bad one, but I was in an environment where I was already treated like a professional athlete, like because the gym there and the setup there they had was, it's literally as good as the setup we have here at the Knights, like the gym and the facilities and, you know, the training fields and stuff like that. And the coaching stuff, like we had a full-time strength and conditioner at a high school. Yeah. Which I didn't have anything like that on the coast. I was sort of just doing weights like in the gym. Like I was working hard, but I didn't really, you know, have like the probably the I guess the smarts like that a S&C or like a proper full-time coach brings. And I definitely noticed as soon as I went into the under-20s program at the Roosters, I was already physically, even though I'm smaller, but I was like physically stronger and fitter than a lot of the guys because I've been training like it for 2 years, and I felt like it gave me a head start. But then also, if you look at it from an educational purpose, like I'm an okay student. I was an okay student, but I ended up getting good grades because I was boarding and they were sort of on my case a bit because they wanted me to have a plan B like you spoke about before. But then also you don't really have a choice at schools like that. It's sort of like they just make sure that you do well. So and then plus, like, you know, I've made a lot of good friends and connections that I didn't have on the Central Coast that I do have now that I went there. But it was good. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. I think that work ethic element and the way it's integrated with education, you look at like the American school system and how the athletes like have to essentially go to college to end up in the professional leagues and things like that. I think we could learn something from that, even if it's just to better equip our athletes. Because, you know, at the end of the day, your career is only for, you know, small period of time. So what would have been your plan B if you didn't get here?
I actually started a degree at UTS when I was in Sydney. So it was studying business. I didn't really like it too much, to be honest. I think it's probably a degree that you kind of do when you're like, oh, I've got okay grades. I'm not sure what I want to study. So I was just like, oh, business will benefit me in the future because I want to do business. but when I moved up to Newcastle, I ended up deferring that. And since I've been up here, I just started doing like my Cert 3 in fitness, I think it is. And I'm going to start doing some study around youth work. And youth work, I think, is probably where I definitely want to go with it.
Yeah, that's awesome. And especially, you know, we're going to get to, you know, the association that you've established. I think that will definitely be a great add-on when you start expanding that. So how old were you when you debuted? Did you debut for the Roosters?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was 19. So it came out of the blue, to be honest. Because I signed there straight like after school. I played under 20s. The first year I went pretty good in the under 20s. I ended up getting the NRL preseason. And when the NRL preseason started, I've said this before and it's pretty funny. If you looked at a depth chart of the halves, you had like Mitchell Pearce. I think Jimmy Maloney just left. So it was Mitchell Pearce, Jackson Hastings, Jaden Nikarima, Tyler Cornish, and then there was me down the bottom. So I was the last one. And then I ended up having a really good preseason, and I ended up getting a game in the Nines over in Auckland, which was a really cool experience, and I felt like it was a good way to get a taste of first grade. Went back to the under 20s, and then we'd struggled. This was the year that Pierce had been suspended for like 8 or 10 games. I can't remember, maybe eight games. Yeah. So, you know, you had Jacko, who was my age, 20, oh, he was 19 at the time, and Jaden Nikarima, who was 19 as well. So these two have sort of been thrown into halfback and 5'8 roles, and we struggled a bit as a team. And then because I was still going good in the 20s, I ended up just sort of getting a bit lucky, and I got a game, I think round 7 against Penrith, and then played the next couple of weeks, PC come back. And I went back to play New South Wales Cup, and then I come back into the first grade team the week after. I had a good game in Cup, and pretty much been playing first grade ever since. So I didn't expect it to come as quickly as it did, but I'm definitely thankful that it worked out that way.
Yeah, that's awesome. Hearing the kind of like the in and out sort of thing, and like knowing at the moment you're just coming back from injury and that sort of stuff, are you conscious of how you look after yourself mentally? Because I can't, there's not many other jobs in the world where one day you're like in and allowed to do your actual work and the next you're out, or, you know, you're so reliant on your body. I think there's something so interesting about that I, you know, I think about when I think about athletes, like, how do you look after yourself?
Yeah, it's the best way to describe it. It's like a roller coaster. It's literally, and it's pretty cliche to say it, but one week you think you're killing it, the next week you get flogged, you know what I mean? Or you might have a good run of games and then all of a sudden you get injured and you miss a few. So I think it's just, for me, it's about trying to stay balanced, like not riding the highs so high and then not taking the lows so low. And there's different things I try to do to sort of make sure I'm centered and balanced. I think like I do a little bit of meditating, and I like things like we sort of take the piss out of it a bit. Like every night at dinner, me, Kaylin, and Tex, because we all live together, we just do like 3 things we're grateful for. But like, it's funny.
Oh, I like that. That's nice.
It's funny. Like we all sort of, but at the end of the day, like there's actual serious meaning behind it, and we're actually really genuine in what we say. So, and we always do it when people come around here, they're coming for dinner and we're like, all right, 3 gratefuls, and they're looking at us like, what are you talking about? And things like that. And I think I know we touched on me being a saltwater boy now, like I find the oceans really, if I'm ever going through a bit, I just get up in the morning and first thing I do is go for a swim and get in the ocean, and Mother Nature always makes you feel a bit better.
Yeah, 100%. What role has culture played, you know, for you growing up? I think that there's an element of that that's about connection to country, and I feel the same thing having grown up by the coast as well. So being an Aboriginal man, and, you know, where does that come into kind of how you wear your pride and kind of everything you do?
Yeah, I think it plays a massive part in everything I do. Obviously, this is why I've enjoyed doing so much stuff around the Cultural Choice Association. I'm going to touch on that in a bit, but just like connecting to culture and learning more about who I am and about my people's history, I think that's the biggest thing. And it's probably as a kid why I enjoyed doing the, you know, like the Indigenous footy camps and stuff, like the Koori under 16s and the Lloyd McDermott camps, and like we got to learn like war dances and, you know, learn how to shake a leg. And I think it's really cool. And as you know, like for us, we didn't get taught it at school, so the way that we sort of learnt was through, I learnt was through all these camps, and then now I'm learning more through helping these youth be able to connect with us and paint our boots. And it's awesome.
Well, I think that's a perfect segue into talking about, you know, what Cultural Choice Association is and how it started and what you're doing now.
Yeah, so I think in my long-term vision, to be honest, like since I've been young and I said that I was going to play NRL, I was thinking about this before. I always had in my head that I wanted to be able to do something to give back to our mob and like our people. And I didn't know exactly what it was going to be. And when I went down to school and I finished school, me, mum, dad, and my little brother Fletcher, who is come on board more in the last couple of years as he's got a bit older, and we spoke about doing something around education. And because, like I said, I've been very fortunate, you know, like I got to grow up in Avoca, and then I got to go to, you know, a great school, and but some people aren't, and we wanted to see if maybe we could help out in giving more opportunities in that way. So we were doing research in that space for a while. And then my cousin Parker in 2017 took his life, and he was only a teenager, and it sort of hit home a bit. He lived out in Dubbo, and after it happened, me and mum had been talking, and I just started having a look at Indigenous youth suicide statistics and just reading some news articles about it. And I didn't realize how bad it was and how severely it affected our communities. And like, I think for Indigenous kids under the age of 14, it's the second leading cause of death. And that stat alone just really resonated with me. And I was just like, how is that possible that can be so? And we as a family then discussed it, and we thought it's probably better for us to narrow our focus into prevention of Indigenous youth suicide and bringing awareness to it, because I feel like it's something that's not spoken about enough.
Yeah, and so your mum and dad have had their business for a little while, I'm assuming, and then it just became a natural sort of thing off that, because your dad's an artist. And where did the Boots for Brighter Futures kind of idea come from?
Yeah, it started around Indigenous Round, because every year that I played first grade, I'd had my dad to go and dot paint my boots. And it was in 2018, my first year here, I got my boots painted by my dad. And then so we just launched the not-for-profit then. So the money that was raised from that donated to the charity, or to the association, sorry. And then I had a chat with Aiden Guerra about it, and he's like, oh, I'd love for your dad to paint a pair of boots for me to play in next year. And I thought this was massive, because this is coming from a non-Indigenous bloke like Doss, but he grew up in Townsville. So he grew up like with a few Murrays, and he's pretty good mates with them. And it was just sort of, it was pretty special when he asked me that. I just thought, like, this guy really cares about this and this issue. And I had a conversation with my mom again, and we just sort of came up with the idea, why don't we see if all the boys want to get their boots painted and donate. So basically donate the boots, and we'll get them painted, and they wear them in a game. And then after we play in them, they'll get signed and auctioned off, and the proceeds will go back into the association, and then some of the proceeds will go to the artists and the organizations that helped us. And all the boys are bought in. That's what was the most special thing to me. Obviously it's something that I'm really passionate about, something that my family's passionate about, but to see the boys actually realize that this is an issue and it's something that they can help fix by a simple action of them donating a pair of boots and just wearing them in a game, it's pretty cool to see that they really care about it as well.
I think you're so right. When there's something about when non-Indigenous people, I don't know, I feel like as a teenager, and partly because of where I grew up and kind of what I saw from the reactions of a lot of the white kids I went to school with who weren't particularly welcoming of culture or kind of, you know, who I was, I was afraid that a lot of non-Indigenous people like didn't want anything to do with us and kind of thought we were this, that and the other and didn't want to help us in any way. But, you know, I've been so privileged in the last couple of years being able to have those conversations like the one you've just described, where you start talking about this stuff and there's people who've like come back and been like, oh my gosh, I want to do as much as I can. Like, this makes me sick. And I think that no normal human being doesn't feel like they'd lose sleep over those statistics that, you know, our young ones as young as 12 are making decisions to end their own life because of, and it's sickening. And I don't think you can ever read that or hear that. You know, I could hear it 1,000 times and I will never feel comfortable with that. And I think that, you know, especially because of essentially our people's relationship to the NRL, because I think we have this like very strong culture and we also like represent a lot in at that high level, is so important. And what, you know, have you seen some of the your other teammates and people who are jumping on kind of you know, changing their attitudes or you know, what are their reactions when you start telling them these sorts of statistics?
Yeah, I think it sort of just hits them like a bit hard, you know, because these things aren't made aware to everyone. Like you sort of got to go and look for these things to find out about it. And you go to put them in the perspective of like, imagine if that was your family or your kid, you know what I mean? And yeah, it's crazy because no one should have to go through that. And like, and everyone has the same reaction. Like, what? Why would a 14-year-old kid do this? Why would a 12-year-old do this? Like, how? Mm-hmm. And this shouldn't be happening. What can we do to help and fix it? And yeah, for the boys, it's just about wearing those boots of pride and just being accepting and open to the stories that the artists paint, because it's pretty special. Like, they put a lot of effort in.
Yeah. What was it like? Because unfortunately, thanks to COVID, you haven't been able to hang out with any of the amazing artists this year, which I hate to rub it in, but it's been pretty amazing. what was it like for you last year with the young people that you were working with, and where were they from?
Yeah, so last year we just had the Newcastle Knights get their boots painted, so my team. And it sort of came from I was going out to visit the Kirinari Hostel once a week or once every 2 weeks, and I formed a pretty good relationship with all the boys there and Lieta and Jade who run it. And I was like, why don't we use these guys? It's because these are kids who live away from home. Like, a lot of these kids are from out, you know, Dubbo, Walgett, up north, up Moree way, and they're away from home. So I thought it might be something good for them, something positive and to have in their life, and to be able to go and see, because they love us. I take Kalen out there and they're in awe of him. So that's what they were just like, so stoked to be able to have boots and then to be able to go and see him on TV, or they got to go to the game last year, which was really cool. So, and then got him in the sheds after, and they got to meet all the boys. And and then we also had the Glen, which is a rehab for Indigenous men on the Central Coast, and then the Baxter Detention Centre up at Kareong. So those two places come on board because mum and dad were doing a bit of work with them around stuff, and I think maybe they were making clapsticks or something for mum and dad, and relationships sort of formed that way. And then through working with Baxter Detention Centre, the Department of Justice sort of wanted to come on board. And I guess, you know, yourself, you've been out to Ruby, and that's how you say it, isn't it? Ruby?
Ruby, but yeah,
Ruby. Ruby. to Ruby at Campbelltown. And I think we got Arana out Dubbo, the Grafton Detention Centre as well as Baxter doing it this year. So because we got the Tigers come on board this year and also the Warriors, so it makes sense for the Tigers guys to get some of their stuff done out at Campbelltown. And you've come on board with the ID Know Yourself, which has helped a lot. You helped us massive there. I thought, I don't know what we're going to do when they pull down up north, but
yeah, when she rang me and she was like, do you know anyone? And I was like, I can help. Like, well, we got this. It was all good.
Yeah, you've been a massive help, to be honest. You've saved us, especially this year, like with COVID, and we thought it was off and we didn't have much time. So thanks so much for that.
Oh, that's all right. Lucky Marley, after a few drinks, when you have a conversation in a nightclub about how I want to be a part of it, don't forget it. That's great.
That's where it started, isn't it?
Did your mum tell you the story about the young boy from down Bateman's Bay? Way?
Amazing.
I think she said we're allowed to talk about it. Or do you want to tell it? Because I think it's pretty awesome.
All right. But if I'm missing anything, you add it, okay?
Okay, I'll back you up at the end.
Yeah, so this guy, he basically had sort of fallen out with his family, hadn't really spoken to him for a while, and I know he was close with one of his cousins who actually passed away from cancer. Is that what it was? Yeah. And he ended up going into one of the detention centers and, hadn't really spoke to his family in a while. And they sort of found it hard to get through to him in the juvie. And when the opportunity to paint the boots came up, the guy who was looking after him sort of thought it'd be a good idea for him to do it, and that it might actually get him to come out of his shell a bit and open up to him, because he'd been a pretty closed off young fella and hadn't really spoken to him or told him how he had felt and stuff like that. And so I think he got to paint Luke Brooks' boots, I'm pretty sure, and he's actually a massive Tigers fan. And part of the program was that when we did it in the juvies, with that they would get like a one-on-one mentor to come in and help them paint. And he hadn't spoken to his auntie in, I think, was it years?
Yeah, it was a long time, I think. And I think it was the mum of the cousin who'd passed away.
Yeah, so he hadn't spoken to her for a long time, and she's actually an Indigenous artist. And the guys approached her to be able to come in and mentor him for the week, and she came in, mentored him for the week, and I think he really loved it and came out of his shell and started to open up to everyone. And they say it's really changed him as a person. And his auntie, which is, I think this is the most special thing about it, who hadn't spoken to her years, and he didn't have anywhere to go once he got out, and now his auntie's offered a place for him to come and stay with her when he gets out. So I think it's the stories like those which really make it, you know, as much as it's a good thing being able to raise money for the cause. And but I think it's more about what actually happens when these guys are able to connect to culture, able to open up to people, feel comfortable to paint in a safe environment, because they might not get that anywhere else. And, my mum actually rang me. She was crying when she told me that. So that's how much it means to us.
But I think the other thing that it brings, and this is what, you know, we just saw when we were in Reby, is their appreciation for feeling like someone cares about them. I think that's especially for our kids who are locked up, and that's, you know, talk about statistics. I think our youth population is like 4.4% of the entire Australian youth population, but 80% of incarcerated youth. And, you know, at, I think it was last year in the Northern Territory, every single young person who was inside was Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander. So those sorts of numbers, and I think you can't deny they're correlated. Like, if kids who end up inside and who, you know, are impacted by mental ill health and suicide, like, they're interconnected, and it's just horrific. And, you know, there's a lot of debate at the moment about raising the age of criminal responsibility from 10 years old. Like, we were working with some of the young boys in Reby who are around 10, 11, and you're like, you're a baby. Like, you have no place being here. Like, this is awful. But then being able to pick up the pair of boots and, you know, see that a name of an NRL player that they recognize, you know, I think that unfortunately there's some voices who will kind of be like, well, it's not all about footy. Like, that's not the only way to be successful and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, that's true. But by showing, you know, even this young boy, by him being able to connect with Luke Brooks, who he obviously looks up to as a Tiger supporter, and know that he's going to know his story. Like, when you're a young kid, that's all you want. Like, you want to feel like people care about you. And, you know, I was obviously never going to be a footballer, I think mostly because of those images of Aboriginal success that I saw on TV growing up, I wanted to be like JT. Like, I was never going to play footy, but I wanted to be like JT because that's what it symbolises. And, it's been such a privilege for us to see it on the ground. And I think, I've been kind of – telling every single person I have the opportunity to talk to, like, you need to get around this because there's something so special here and I've not seen it happen in the way that you guys are doing it. So what I know the goal is to raise 25,000. What would that enable you guys to do?
I think it's probably just to scale up this program, like be able to run it with all, the dream is to do it with all 16 clubs, and that's the plan, that's the long-term vision. But and then to not just have it as like, oh, here's the boots and paint it, but to be able to run mental health programs with all of these guys that do it, and cultural workshops as well. So they're the sort of the big things that we want to be able to do. And I know in Dubbo, with the justice guys out there, they actually got a week dedicated to mental health programs. So they had a few organizations, local organizations, come on board. Where are they? I think it was like they had PCYC, Headspace did some stuff, and then a few of the schools. So they had some of the schools out Dubbo be able to come in and run mental health workshops and then one-on-one mentors with these kids. So with these youth, so they were actually able to feel, like I said before, feel comfortable enough around people to be able to open up and not have to do it in a big group. So they had Dubbo Mian School, Lincoln Education, Mission Australia, and D-Hub Barama. So these were organizations that sort of participated in it. But the plan will be to do that with everyone who paints the boots. So imagine we had 16 clubs, 20, let's just go with 20 people get their boots done. That's 320 kids, youth, if I'm correct, is my maths on.
I'm terrible at maths, so I'll stick to that.
Yeah, so that's 320 people's lives that we'd be able to impact in a positive way by letting them connect with culture while also learning about mental health and how to build resilience, but then also being able to connect with and build a relationship with a mentor one-on-one so that they actually feel like they're important and wanted, you know what I mean?
100%. Mm-hmm. It's always hard, like I sometimes hate asking you to like people to think too far into the future, but say like 10 years from now, you know, what's like the ultimate goal for what it looks like or where it's gotten to?
Yeah, I think all 16 clubs is probably the ultimate goal. And then I know this was the long-term plan before the boot stuff happened, but we wanted to run mentoring programs in schools where high risk youth are of this. So out in the countries, be able to go in and run programs, mentoring programs, and equip these guys, the youth with skills to do peer-to-peer mentoring and to be able to, I just want to make this conversation something that they can go and open up with and feel comfortable enough with people that they can, because, you know, everyone's got their own demons and it's not good holding on to them, and everyone's going through their own battles. So I think if people are able to open up and feel comfortable enough to be able to open up, it's only going to do them positive.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that, you know, having people like yourself and the other players who've are getting around this, being role models and destigmatizing talking about mental health is a really great step as well. I think especially as men who are overwhelmingly the statistics of suicide as well, coming from what's, you know, a very masculine sport and things like that I think it's going to have a really big impact on a lot of people in a lot of ways. And so, you know, I think it's quite obvious you are a role model for a lot of young people already, and now you're all kind of like reaching them in lots of different ways with your own podcast and all that kind of stuff as well. You know, to those people who look up to you or, you know, maybe want to be like you when they grow up and things like that, what would be your message of advice, or even if you could talk to your younger self, what would you want him to know now?
Yeah, I just think for me personally, like I guess it's just come from knowing how lucky and fortunate I am. So I just wanted to be able to go and impact people's lives who weren't lucky enough to, you know, had the same start at life that I was, the chance to. And I think if I was just go back to my younger self, I think working hard is the biggest thing. And you know this yourself, like I see how much work you do and you never stop. You're always flat out grinding and it pays off eventually. But I think the biggest thing is just finding what you're passionate about and just working hard for it, you know, because if you don't enjoy something, you're not going to go and do everything you can to be successful at it. So, and don't be in a rush. I think I've been in a rush before. I know a lot of people in a rush, but don't be in a rush to find what it is, but I'm sure it will come to you and just enjoy the ride. And I always say this, smell the roses every now and then.
Smell the roses. That's a classic. You know, I think I could probably take your advice of not rushing. I might have to just mentally lock that one in. But thank you so much, Connor, not only for your time today, but for everything that you're doing. I think it is, you know, something that I can honestly say I really believe in. And I think that I you're going to get to those 16 clubs, and even if it's me having to bash down their doors with you, it's really special. And I really encourage everyone who hears this to, if you have $2 to spare, or if you can skip one coffee this week and throw it at the GoFundMe that is now live for Cultural Choice Association, you will not regret supporting this.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. And thanks for all the help so far. You've been so good. My mum loves you. So you've been a massive, massive help for her. Yeah, she's good. She works hard. And I'm very, very grateful for the work that mum, dad, and my brother Fletcher have put in. So, I mean, it's been hard this year. I haven't really been able to contribute all that much because I'm kind of under house arrest with these lockdown rules. So, yeah, in the bubble. But that's the biggest part that's been killing me the most, not actually being able to go and help you guys and meet all the artists and everyone that's helping make this positive change. So thanks again.
No worries.
Thank you so much, Connor, for taking the time out to jump on and share your story today. And thank you also for allowing us to be a part of this journey. It's truly been such an honor, and I can't wait to see what happens next with Cultural Choice Association. If you'd like to support this work, please check out their Instagram and their website, which are both linked in the show notes, and consider donating whatever you can to their GoFundMe. You can also help by sharing this episode and this story, as well as their page on your own socials or with friends and family too. If you are enjoying the show, as always, it is super helpful if you subscribe wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. Give us a good rating if it's on Apple and share it with people who might be interested in it as well. Always Was, Always Will Be Our Stories is written, hosted, edited, but no longer produced by Marley Silva. I'd like to take this time to introduce you to a very special addition to the team. I'm no longer just a one-woman podcast production, which is really helpful. My brand new producer I'd love to introduce you to is my sister, Keely Silva.
Yeah, that's right. You heard it here first. Finally got my start, and this won't be the end of me.
And how do you feel about coming on as a producer? Tell everyone about your experience in the audio production industry.
I've always considered myself an amateur DJ, and I think this is similar.
So do you see this as a
pathway to a DJ pathway career? To DJ. Yes, definitely.
DJ Quicksilver in the house.
Yeah, right.
Yep. Play us your favourite sounds at the moment.
Oh, well, we've got a few goodies here. Personal favourite, because it's usually what I hear. So I'm hilarious.
Great.
And then this one's pretty funny.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for listening to Always Was, Always Will Be Our Stories. We do make this podcast on beautiful Darawal country, where we were very lucky to be born and raised, and pay our respects to the elders and ancestors of this land every single day, past and present. All right, Kiels, it's your first show. You get to do the send-off.
Oh, very excited. Thanks, guys. We'll see you next week, and stay deadly.